This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. I just got back from a trip to Ohio. Boy, it's a long drive out there from central New York, but it was good to get out there. I left and I had 2 feet of snow on the ground here in Syracuse, and then I'm headed out west, and I didn't really dress as good as I thought I needed to or appropriately, and it was a little colder out in Ohio than I had anticipated. And then I get back here and we've got a rainstorm and pretty much all the snow is gone. So that kind of changes some of this, you know, last part of the hunting season dynamics for some of those that still are out there hunting. We have a late season here in New York and a lot of people look forward to that. That's just after Christmas. One thing I do want to mention is sometimes when I meet with clients, they have logged their property, and in the process of logging their property, they don't really have a complete understanding of the aftermath. Some of the issues start with making the right selection of trees. I hear this constantly, like, they did a select cut. And many times thereafter, a select cut is not an adequate strategy. And so, you know, I didn't coin this, I don't believe, but, you know, we have a thinning technique. It's called variable thinning, and it defines a purpose. And there's kind of three methodologies with cutting timber. You've heard improvements or timber stand improvements for economic reasons, forest stand improvements for habitat / economic reasons. And then we have another one called mass production or mass production for particular wildlife benefit. And so the combination of all three of those is kind of the strategy when looking at a forest stand. And that has a lot of strategy after the facts to maintain, because once you cut an area, you know, that regeneration or that next phase of tree species, you know, considering residual trees and even wolf trees or, you know, larger trees that are on the landscape need to be managed appropriately. And there needs to be some real thought put into it. And so if you're not getting that information during your consulting visit or working with a forester, you know, you really kind of ask yourself, what is this going to look like after the fact, and how am I going to maintain it or establish a better forest stand for either future timber regeneration or just maintenance, et cetera. And I just employ people to have some deeper meaning behind managing some of those trees that are suppressed or co-dominant, the regeneration, all those things that are part of the next phase of your cutting. And I see that on most client properties. And the only thing I would say is, I'm not trying to recommend things that I would do, but make sure you have somebody that comes in that it's going to meet your needs when it comes to layout. And I'm not just talking layout for purposes of deer movement, layout on a harvest strategy so there's less damage to residual trees and they're not putting their big heavy machines in areas you don't want them. So just wanted to recommend that. So I have a brand new guest, Taylor Henry. Some of you may or may not know Taylor. He has really, I would say, amplified and revitalized Acres USA. I'm a subscriber to their magazine. I've been to their events. I wasn't able to go this year because of some other commitments, but I'm super impressed with Taylor. He's got a great podcast. Some of you all should listen to his podcast. We're going to get him on the line and talk to him a little bit about a few different topics. One of those surrounding the recent bill that has been kind of in communication with the public, this regeneration bill where there's some money being allocated to new types or strategies in farming. I think a lot of us in this field are already employing those things, but there may be some money associated with that. And obviously money creates interest. So we might chat on that. And then some things that Taylor's doing on his own property and things that he's learned from past mistakes, et cetera. So let me get him on the line. Taylor, how you doing?
Good, John. Thanks for having me.
You know, quickly, I know you're out of Wisconsin, but I wanted to have you introduce yourself and Acres. I want people to pay attention to Acres, and I just, there's so many smart people. Some of them have been on this podcast, and you're one of those guys. So I want you to just give some background to you and talk a little bit about, you know, your business.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I grew up in Wisconsin. I bought Acres USA 2 years ago, almost to the day. Acres was founded back in 1971, and it's the oldest ecological, organic, regenerative agriculture media / publishing company in North America. We've published magazine issues each month since 1971. We just had our 50th annual EcoAg conference and trade show. We had over 1,100 farmers from all over the world come to Madison, Wisconsin, and over 100 different businesses in the trade show are some of the most innovative businesses in agriculture. And then we also have a bookstore that consists of 450 or so SKUs. We've published over 130 titles. We just published 4 books last year, and we have some good ones coming up this next year too. So our focus is how can large to medium scale, you know, production scale type agriculture producers have economic success while following soil health principles. We believe that you can have economic success without jeopardizing your future soil bank.
Now, I recently watched, a series of videos with you. You went out to go visit Gabe Brown. So sometimes when I'm laying in bed and I'm thinking, I tend to go to YouTube. I think a lot of folks do that. And I watched those, I think it was a series of videos, maybe it was a part one, part two, and you traveled around asking him questions about his farm. If anybody's not familiar with Gabe Brown, go look him up. He's a pretty interesting guy. He's out of South Dakota, if I'm correct.
North Dakota.
Okay. Explain to me a little bit about what you learned when you engaged with him and some of the things that you took away from that visit.
Yeah. So, I mean, I came up through the hunting world. That's where my obsession with farming came, well, obsession with land came from. And then I bought a property for the purpose of hunting. And then while we were under contract with that property, I started looking into agriculture. And the first book I read was Dirt to Soil by Gabe Brown. And it just, I think the story and how he talks about everything, it just makes tons of sense. So he was always on like number one bucket list. He's probably, you know, in that top echelon of people that have moved beyond agriculture as being like famous. I mean, he just went over to Prince Charles Place 2 weeks before we were there.
Yeah.
So first of all, I was, you know, kind of fanboy and when I was there, but to see the operation, it's management within the guardrails of nature. You know, they have thousands of acres grazed by cattle. They grow cover crops. They're moving completely into a pretty much a perennial system. His son has taken over the farm, which is another thing that is pretty impressive, because when you look at agriculture right now, like, you know, the generational exchange is one of the biggest problems. So anybody who successfully hands on to a successful operation down to their next generation is impressive to look at. But, you know, they are in Bismarck, North Dakota, and they graze cattle 365 days a year, and they didn't feed one bale of hay last year. That's pretty insane. Anyone who's ever raised cattle to be able to, and when I was out there, it was, I think, August or September, you know, I was looking at the grass and, you know, it's North Dakota grass. They hadn't had rain in a month or two, and they carry that all the way through the whole year. So that's like the most impressive thing to me. Like, you want to talk about an economic successful operation, there's very little input cost on that. And the key is the movement of the cattle, the management practices. You know, each piece of ground really only gets grazed one time a year. But a cool thing with Gabe was, I don't know if it was in his book or maybe a podcast I listened to, because of all the cover cropping that he did, you know, he started cover cropping in the late 90s. Their DNR came to him at one point and were like, what's going on with your farm? Why are you baiting deer? Because they had done aerial type studies. Yeah. And for whatever reason, there was like every deer in a 15 mile radius was on his cover crop field in the winter. That's where the connection.
We had John Kemp on the podcast, and that was a similar kind of tone to discussion, is when you're creating these, I'll just say, you know, systems of success, and there's high functionality within the soil and plants, that, you know, you create that attraction level, and these small areas of improvement you make on your property become focal points for wildlife. So to your point, is well received. That I didn't mean to cut you off, but that was just, that's a great point. You know, the practices lead to some form of success. Let me just pull you back in one little bit on this. So I like the fact that, you know, you were kind of enamored with him. And I do like the fact that you have an interest in hunting, and, you know, that just made you kind of more worldly and thinking about, you know, the agronomics of things. What was something in your engagement with Gabe that we were like a little enamored with, but also surprised about, that maybe you didn't know before you got there? Was there something that he talked to you about or showed you that was like, wow, that's pretty impressive? And I'm overly impressed with the fact that they do not get the rain volume. And I saw those images of those fields, and they were not like brown. You know, it's like, how's that even feasible? It's impressive.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest thing is we went over to his neighbor's field, who I think he said 20 years of no-till, which, if you look at the superficial level of soil health, everyone wants to go no-till. And that's, you know, then if they check that box, then we're moving in the right direction, which is true in some sense. Like, if you're as conventional gets, if you start doing no-till instead of, you know, hard tillage, you're moving in the right direction. But to see the difference in his cover crop fields versus the neighbor's no-till field, just the soil aggregation, the way the soil crumbles, the form of the soil, that was like, this is what we're trying to do. And that's the diversity of the cover crop species, but then also the livestock integration on those fields. That's the biggest difference. So that was the most, to see the difference like that was pretty impressive.
Now, you mentioned he's got perennial cropping systems, and I recall that part of the video, but I don't recall specifically what were his perennial systems consisting of from plants. Did he describe that in any detail? Do you recall?
Whatever grows.
Okay.
So they let their native seed bank express itself. And I think you can do that with grazing systems through aggressive, proper grazing management. The theory or the thought processes, and we saw it out there, is, and I've seen it at my place, that your natural seed bank will come back. So Gabe's hardcore. Like, they don't put amendments on their soil. They don't give their cattle mineral. They don't give their cattle water in the winter. They have to eat snow. So he's pretty radical. like I wouldn't, anyone who's like doing a normal operation, I wouldn't just jump into that next year. Like, you're going to have a problem. But this is over a long, long time that he's gotten to the point where they can do this. You know, one, if you remember in that video, we pull up in one of his pastures that hadn't been grazed yet, and we're standing in, you know, 6-7 foot blue stem. And he said he's never seeded any of that blue stem. So that blue stem came, you know, from 20 years. He thought it had been maybe like 5 to 10 years since they had, you know, done anything with those fields or set them back to plant any cover crops. But we're talking how many years that seed sat in the soil bank and then it expressed itself in the last couple of years. I mean, he was like a little kid in a candy shop talking about that blue stem. And it was impressive. And you know, you think about that, like that's the thing that they were eating thousands of years ago. Like when we had these giant ruminants going across the landscape, they were eating these giant, tall, warm season grasses, these native grasses. And that's truly like the ecosystem healing itself and going back to the way it was. That's true regeneration.
This is totally left, but an interesting topic. I was listening to a friend of mine and we were talking about some related plants and how they interform these relationships. And so like you got grapevine, and grapevine will travel up some species of plant that basically is tall, and the vine itself strengthens as it reaches the canopy, and then it grows and it creates weight. And then it basically, if it's a diseased tree or if it's a canopy that's stressed, you know, that particular vine knocks that plant over, kind of like a mastodon or like an elephant or what have you would knock over a tree, creates disturbance. And so that creates that recycling of resource. And then that grape hits, you know, that vine hits the ground or portions of it remain intact or tied to other tree species. And it basically functions the same way an animal would when there isn't disturbance. So it's like, you know, the totally interesting concept to think about is what are these plants actually intending to do? And are they adapting to their environment to create similar disturbance regimes? And then all that relates to putting resources on the ground, coarse woody debris that are resources for the next generation of plants, which increase, you know, fungal dominance, et cetera. So I just bring that up is, you know, you're bringing up these ideas where this plant is now expressing itself for whatever reason, which is hard to understand why that plant signaled and generated, but it's serving a purpose on the landscape. And sometimes, you know, we try to put this whole caption on what that's actually doing and why, but, you know, sometimes plants, they mean to be in those locations. And so take advantage of that almost opportunistically for wildlife. And I think that's the piece of benefit is now you've got a cover source that's retaining moisture that, you know, is digging deep into the ground, essentially harnessing nutrients and then exposing and sharing those with its cohorts of plants adjacent. And it's like, okay, well, I think it's intending to do that because the system is right. You know, it's ripe for those opportunities. So it's just interesting to think about those ideas. I want to flip on you a little bit. So I like that you got the hunting background and I have followed you quite a bit. So I know quite a bit about, you know, some of the things I've seen on your own personal operation, which you've explained. Obviously I read the magazine as much as I can, especially when I'm on the road, when I'm at night, I bring your magazine with me and I sit in bed and read while I'm on the road. I've really noticed that, you know, you have some good tie-ins with Mark Shepard and Thomas Mills and I went out last year, obviously to the Acres conference. And we sat in the Shepard presentation and some of the stuff that Shepard employs, I think you've kind of leveraged, and I know you have a good relationship with him. What are some of the takeaways on your farm recently, whether it relates to something you're learning individually or strategies that you have that have been kind of like a shift in perspective? You know, you're coming and you've got all this feed, you've got all these loops into these pretty great minds, which is fortunate for you. And you're basically extracting out what you think is sensible in your operation. And does any of that relate to wildlife benefit that you've seen? So I wanted you to talk about a little bit. It's a loaded question, but I want to hear about your operation and things that you're learning that has helped you be successful.
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, this took me a little while to figure out, but when you take the information in from all these people, you know, you can read 100 different books. You have to fit your own context into it. So like it's always best to take one or two ideas from somebody, figure out how that fits into your situation. What are your goals? What are you trying to accomplish? Instead of trying to completely copy their operation and then it not work exactly the way that they described it. And then you go back and say, hey, that didn't work. I think all of these ideas are meant to be, you know, pieces of them are supposed to be taken and then you fit them into your own context. So with Mark, the idea was, you know, I came to him through hunting right away because that was his book was the second book I read, Restoration Agriculture. And he's talking about planting all of these woody crop species. And to me, I'm like, well, you plant all these apple trees, chestnut trees in these alleyways, and then you can do stuff in the alleyways like food plots. Like, how would that not turn into an absolute like deer haven? So, you know, one thing I've learned with his, because he talks about the stun method in his book where he wants the species and trees to succeed on their own. Like, he doesn't want to baby them at all. And, you know, we've watched a lot of trees die over the last couple of years using that method. But then, you know, we also graze his farm and you go out there and it's a rainforest of food. So it still works. It's just, there's little things you have to adjust. Like, we have cattle grazing in between our tree rows. Like, we probably need to do a little bit more to protect the trees and make sure that they can make it to the next year. But the key is mimicking your natural ecosystem. Like, that's the basis of Mark's talks and teachings is, you know, take what, you know, we're in an oak savanna region here in Southwest Wisconsin. So you can necessarily need the exact native species that belong here, but you can mimic them, you know, so you can mimic them by putting in a chestnut tree or an oak tree or some sort of bushy species. And you have these multi-layers of food that grow throughout the whole year. So that's probably one thing I would say on my place. I've noticed the most is the structure of the trees and the paddock systems and how we have planted certain systems truly moves the deer in certain ways. And it's been pretty cool to watch.
Well, let's talk a little bit about cattle interaction with deer specifically. Have you noticed in your systems that they basically engage in the same paddocks, or have you noticed that they sparse themselves out? I think a lot of this has relationships to cover. But there have been studies on this particular topic in various scenarios. But when you have, I guess, high levels of food, do the deer follow? This is a similar premise to how this works with bison and then elk following bison. Do the deer follow the cattle grazing in some capacity some time after? Have you noticed any like trends of movement or relationships of deer and cattle interaction?
Well, you know, obviously deer don't eat grass. Like, cattle's main diet is the grass.
Right.
But where they do mix together, so like we'll bale graze cattle and we don't worry too much about the residue of the bales. So like, I want heavy residue left on the soil because then that kind of, I don't have to till it. I don't have to do anything else with it and it's ready for a planting next year. And then we bring in the pigs in the summertime. They eat a lot of the hay residue. They mix it up. They stir up the soil a little bit, and then we can actually drill right into the places that we did that right after the pigs, or broadcast in with the pigs. It depends how much disturbance was done.
Sure.
So then after that, these cover crop mixes that we've been planting, we can either graze them once with the cattle or twice, depending on when they got planted. And these same cover crop mixes are pretty dang good for deer. Like, deer's diets and cattle diets are a little bit different, but they're pretty similar. Any of these, you know, think about the deer food plot mixes. I mean, that was another thing that just clicked to me. Like, you look at all these deer food plot mixes, and then you look at the cover crop mixes that people are pushing for diversity, and they're pretty much the same thing. So, you know, anytime we have maybe a little bit of a crappy area, and our farm is kind of split. Like, we have our perennial pastures, and then in the backside, you know, closer to the woods where it's away from the road, that's like our deer hunting area. So in that area, we pretty much just look like, where is like, give me an a long, narrow half acre, and we rotate these spots. We'll drop bales there in the winter or spring, let the cattle feed on them, run the pigs through it, graze the cattle after the pigs, and then seed it down. And these beautiful food plots come up, and I always mix in perennial grasses with it, because I like to go, you know, say a 3 to 5 year rotation before I set anything back. So I want that grass to come back. But you have these clovers, which obviously cattle love, deer love, and then these, you know, multi-species cover crop mixes where, you know, turnips, radishes, chicory, hairy vetch. I love sorghum. I don't think deer do much with sorghum, but it's a beautiful cattle feed. Oh, and birds love it.
There's some varieties of sorghum that they've hybridized, as well as, you know, some original ones that are non-hybridized that do have high level attractions for deer specifically. Actually, deer will eat. I've seen them eat full stems of sorghum at a certain stage. That's an oddity, but it does happen. I've seen them strip off the leaves and eat the heads. So, yeah, there is a bit of overlap there as well.
I'd imagine right now they're reaching up and grabbing off a seed head.
Yeah.
And if you ever, you know, like for us, we use sorghum as winter stockpile feed because it holds its nutritional quality so well. Like if I were to go out, we still have one sorghum field left that has probably 8 to 9 other species with it. I can snap that stalk off and bite into it, and it kind of tastes like syrup. So yeah. Like there's still a sweet juiciness in it. The cattle will have to drink.
Well, it's in those fields, the fields that you have set up, Taylor, what's the combination? Can you just kind of explain a little bit, because that's in your cover crop mix. What do you generally have in those?
Well, it changes a little bit. So like when we plant, you know, we run the pigs pretty much through these fields from May to, you know, middle of August. And then once we get to middle of August, we send the pigs into the woods. So then we prep all the fields. So after July 15th here, I changed the mix a little bit into more of a cool season mix. The warm season mix, I do buckwheat, variety of clovers, yellow sweet clover, red clover, white clover. Hairy vetch I like a lot with sorghum. As you described earlier with the vines wrapping around, the hairy vetch will actually wrap around the sorghum stem and climb up to, I bet we have some hairy vetch that's 9 feet tall wrapped up on the sorghum stems right now. And then peas, barley, oats. And then as we get into maybe later in the fall, we might, you know, pull out maybe buckwheat, or maybe we don't put in sorghum. But I don't know. To me, even buckwheat, like I planted some buckwheat in August this year, and it still, to me, did the job that it's supposed to do. It got to the flowering stage and got some maturity to it. And, you know, buckwheat's one of the best plants you can plant to help correct some soil deficiencies.
Are you in the springtime in those areas where you have those fall crops? I mean, some will be winter hardy and they'll survive. Like in some of my combinations I use, and I've mentioned this on the podcast for those that don't recall, but what the combination I recommend this year for a lot of food plots essentially was kind of later plantings, because there's a pivotal stage in a plant's physiology where they're most, you know, they're more highly preferred. And as a combination of you know, winter rye, wheat, oats, and hairy vetch with a red clover. I mean, there's a combination that I recommended for folks that where I was planting in my latitudes. But when it comes to the spring period, you know, there's usually kind of I have a rule set where there needs to be 2 to 4, preferably more plants that have winter hardiness that are kind of taking up that physical space. You know, they're able to, you know, survive the cold period in the wintertime and then develop, you know, through the spring period. And then we generally either crimp and then crimp no-till or just no-till through those particular areas, leaving that structure for fawning, bugging, et cetera. So on your example, are you sending hogs through in the summer, you know, the spring period into the summer period? Are you no-tilling into those areas? Are you grazing them? What's typically your strategy with cattle and pigs?
We would graze it. So if I hit a place with the pigs and set it completely back in a year, I won't hit it the next year. So in that mix, I want, that's some of the reasons I like barley seems to come back pretty well. And then that's good grass. Obviously the clovers, hairy vetch, chicory, things like that come back. But I, you know, for a grazing system, I need to get some grass in there. So I put in annual ryegrass, which doesn't usually make it back, but then I also throw in perennial ryegrass and then some orchard grass. So we have a good grass mix, because with cattle, you can't just, you can, we've done it. You don't like to just throw them on a field full of legumes.
Yeah.
And that is one of the scary things about setting them back, because the next, you know, year number two, they will come back into some beautiful clover looking food plots. But we want to graze it. So that whole next year, it gets grazed. Unless, if I don't plan, or if I plan on saying, like, I want to get like a bean, like a soybean in the next year, where I'll no-till into it. Then we'll bale graze it again. If I bale graze it heavy, we won't have too much that grows up through that residue. But I can drill right into the residue, and it does really well.
Just for the audience, where if I keep it, can you explain a little bit about bale grazing? Because I'm not sure that's something that we would all be familiar with.
Yeah, so like, you know, a lot of people would have, you know, you drive through the landscape in rural America, you'll see cattle out on pasture with bale rings and a bale in it. We've pretty much got rid of all, we don't use bale rings anymore, but we'll place out bales into the places that we want, either to set it back and do a cover crop field, or in places that, you know, it's good for the wind, whatever it may be. We essentially just set the bales out and let the cattle eat them. And then we still have hot fences in the winter. So as we move through our rotation, we'll set bales out for, say, like a month. We open a gate, and generally speaking, they move about every 10 days into the paddock with bales. So what happens is then they eat the bales down, they poop and pee on it. There's a bunch of residue left over. It's pretty much, I call it like a nutrient bomb to that area. You'd have to mess up pretty bad not to be able to grow a crop in those spots next year.
One other question, Taylor, is when you're going through and having, you know, the cattle go in, and is there any timing or anything associated with, depending on the we're always worried about puddling areas that are having compaction issues as relate to like mass, you know, ruminants, you know, kind of just, you know, existing on those particular areas. Have you noticed any negative effects with having cattle in some of these areas from a compaction standpoint, or is there a strategy that you would suggest people consider as they're moving animal from paddock to paddock, et cetera?
Ideally, the ground's frozen solid, or it's dry enough where you don't have it. It's interesting because, like, a little bit of cattle print, a little bit of a hoof going into the ground, it's like if I can stick my finger down into the print and it's up to either like my middle knuckle, I don't want it like all the way up to my main knuckle on my hand. Then I see issues. You'll have, you know, you'll see thistles come back next year. But if you can get the right type of impact there, I like a little bit of hoof print in the ground, like a little bit of, people call it pugging, but the right amount, those areas always bounce back the best. I prefer to do it on frozen ground. When we're in the muddy seasons, we will roll the bales out, if that makes sense. Or ideally during muddy season, we have areas where we can, you know, get back to grazing. Too.
I've liked in some of the forest stands where there's dense understory, and particularly if there's usually in our areas it's buckthorn thickets with honeysuckle, is we've bale grazed where you cut a roll in there. This is a client property that I worked on. We pushed a roll in and then had all the cattle go in and just trample those areas and add the fertility, and it's kind of like that starting point where, you know, some of the fertility amendment that they add, plus just their activity in general, is a disturbance function that kind of resets those areas. And pigs can do the same thing. If you can have pigs go in an area and basically, you know, kind of root and destroy some of the existing vegetation, you know, that is actually as productive sometimes as going in and cutting and removing tree species specifically. And so that's a strategy to use animals to your advantage. And that's something that I've done on a few property designs that I've worked with, and just a way to kind of introduce animal disturbance as a technique.
Well, and pigs belong in the woods. That's how we use the pigs. So we have a buck barn problem on our property.
Yep.
And we can run the pigs in for those last, you know, August and September into a little bit of October. And the deer hunters out there might be cringing a little bit because they are vacuum cleaning all the acorns up. But what I have seen is it doesn't really matter. Like the second we move the pigs out, the deer move right back in. So I like to see them clear out the understory. They don't do much with the buckthorn, but then the buckthorn's a lot easier to deal with in the winter because everything's kind of, you know, scraped down to the ground. You can get in there and actually use your chainsaws and go right down to the base of the ground with those buckthorn trees.
Yeah, and it's a good strategy for some of these other areas where you have these clear cuts and you're trying to manage the vegetation. And I think cattle do an excellent job of trampling. So, you know, you can use trampling as a technique to create opportunities for other small animals to come in and make some destructive, activities in those particular regions. But, you know, what I'm doing on properties just for the buckthorn removal, and I've mentioned this probably so many times in this podcast, is you can cut them to death, you can spray them to death, or you can just repurpose them. And I'm trying to repurpose, you know, that particular plant and use it stem, either chip it or use it for structure. It's great for fencing. I mean, there's just a lot of benefits to, and it lasts a long time on the landscape. Like it doesn't degrade at a really fast rate, which is kind of helpful if you're using it for fencing. So there's definitely some benefits. I mean, it actually would be interesting to create like these. And I actually did this on my own hunting property, is taking some of that material and I generated corridors, travel corridors with the, you know, the buckthorn specifically. And it worked really, really well. And I'm doing a bunch of that this year, but introducing some native grasses in particular areas. But let's get off that real quick. I want to go. So are you not adding any?
Go ahead. I would say too, how I use it is I'll cut them all down and then I'll push them down. Like you picture our farm, it's like a big ridge system that goes out. And then the end of it, where all the wood starts, it all kind of drops down to a creek. So all these points, I will cut the buckthorn on the flatter areas.
Yep.
And then push them all down and essentially kind of use them like terraces.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we'll have like these parallel lines that work with our system. If you ever, you know, learn about Mark Shepard's water management stuff, the whole farm set up on like a key line system with the purpose of water management. So those like terrace type brush piles are treated the exact same. And then where we clear them off and then we pull that canopy back, the point is then that those should be more silviculture, silvopasture type settings. And then the cattle can come through and get some grazing in. And then the pigs will do a lot like calmer disturbance in future years. The first time we send a pig into an area into like a taken over buckthorn patch, I let them pretty much go wild in there. After, once we have more of a civil pasture type setting, it's a lot more light disturbance and then just overseeding the area after they leave. But if I can get cattle in there to graze, you know, in the spring, and then we usually do like one rotation in the spring, and then I'll save the areas until, you know, the hottest, you know, one of those hot weeks in the summer, run them in there. And we don't have a problem with the buckthorn coming back in that setting. Don't take my promise. This buckthorn's pretty impressive, but
yeah, no, that's how we've done it. That's a great strategy too. Yeah, I love that. I think that would give people some more opportunities to think about, you know, animal use.
And that is a giant structure thing. The deer will walk right along those lines, and then we have vertical lines cut into them where we can get the fences down. And, you know, they take those too.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I think some folks might not be familiar with key line, P.A. Yeoman's key line design. And I think Mark Shepard, what is it called? Mark Shepard's book,
Water for Any Farm.
Yeah. Water for Any Farm. That's a great read. If anybody has a chance to read that, you'll find some interest. And he also has a technical guidance book. Mark's a really sharp guy. He's thought through a lot of this stuff, and He's got a really good business, and we were out there talking with some of his applicators and how they're doing layout, and a lot of it relates to a lot of the wildlife stuff that, that Thomas and I are both doing. So there's quite a bit of overlap, as you already entailed or detailed here. I'm interested more. So I love the Gabe Brown piece, and I suggest people go watch that video with you and him. I thought you did a great job. When it comes to like amendments on your farm, are you adding amendments to any of the fields?
No, we never had any amendments to anything. Just the bale grazing. To me, the bale grazing accomplishes that. Now, because of Acres, we're using some of our advertisers' products. Like, I love C90 stuff.
Oh, me too.
And I see a really nice pop in pretty much anywhere we put that. Like, any place that we plant a new seeding, we'll throw some of that in. You know, like, I like Midwest BioEgg food plot mixes with the fertilizer in it. I don't even know what their food plot company is called. It's something like MBA or something. I think it works well for a grazing system too. I add some more species into the mix, but you know, to me, instead of fertilizing the whole place, I'd rather just go acre by acre with these mixes, and then they're my little food plots for the year too.
Yeah.
Other than that, though, the bale grazing is. That's where all the fertility comes from. And then, you know, the rotational grazing throughout the year. Like, the perennial pastures are beautiful, man. We grow. You sit the first couple of years and you're like, am I ever going to grow grass? And now we just have, you know, we have grass that's over our heads in the spring.
I have two questions for you. You mentioned C90. Can you explain a little bit what that is? And then, Thomas and I will probably talk in another podcast about the BioAg stuff, but what is C90 and why would you choose to put that on a landscape? Like, you're adding salt to a landscape. Do you feel like that's a benefit? Because a lot of people are worried that that might be a negative. You know, salting the earth could be a negative. What are your thoughts there?
Well, if you are under the belief that all this whole landscape was under a sea at one point, that's kind of the basis of it. And we have a couple good books on it. Food Power to Sea, and then Sea Energy Agriculture is two of the books that we published and describes it. Essentially, you know, we were all under an ocean at one point. So the nutrients that are in sea salt are in our soil. So they boost up the macronutrients in the soil. And they probably the most impressive thing about C90 is their sourcing. Like, they can actually source the sea salt from a safe place that doesn't have toxic chemicals in it. I mean, that would be the main concern if you're using anything from an ocean. Is this all the runoff and all the issues with it? But because of where they're at and how they source it, it's very clean, and it provides pretty much kind of like a buffet type macronutrient shot to the soil.
Yeah. Yeah. And the 90 representing, you know, at least 90 nutrients approximately in that mix, you know, so it's a smorgasbord to your point of nutrients in a extremely healthy. I mean, there isn't really disease. And Dr. Murray, who's one of the predominant kind of initiators of that whole discussion. And if you read some of the material, it's like, hey, we put this in the fields and things started growing. Apples started getting bigger. You know, plants starting to develop, and they're putting a huge amount of sea salt in these particular areas with massive results. And I can't agree with you more. So I think randomly appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah. I mean, so like the core of Acres, the first things that like made Acres kind of famous was the founder, Charles Walters, got a hold of this professor from Missouri, Dr. William Albrecht. And Albrecht was like the first guy, and he was in the 50s and 60s, starting to, you know, say, hey, we probably shouldn't, you know, dive headfirst into this conventional, you know, industrial type agriculture, because we're seeing the soil start being depleted of the main minerals and nutrients that it thrives on. So we published 8 books from a series of his lectures from the 50s and 60s. And that's kind of the basis of, like, you know, have you ever heard of Gary Zimmer, the biological farming? Anyone who talks about minerals, and mineral balancing, their at least beginner level education or core understanding of it most likely came from Albrecht. And if you think about that, and this ties back to why the deer are showing up and why they're choosing our food plot fields or Gabe Brown's food plot fields over their neighbors, is because they are mineral deficient. Like they are seeking the minerals. Like if we're planting these plants that pull up these specific minerals out of the soil, and we're getting it closer to a balanced type soil system that it originated from, of course the animals are going to head to that. They have the senses to seek that out. And I think that is like the main idea of all this. Like if we can get our soils back to these properly mineral balanced powerhouses like they are, we don't need all the inputs. And I think we've seen enough of it. Like the wildlife will flock to it and seek for it just because of that.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. And I think we've tried to express this on the podcast that you can do things smarter. And, you know, we talked earlier, you mentioned biomimicry and some of the things. And I think I need to do a podcast on, you know, like the 9 principles of biomimicry that I employ with client designs, because it seems like those are the things that are lost in the general consensus of folks that are, you know, tied into just watching like YouTube binging, as a lot of people do. I want to switch topics on you, and I kind of want to finish this here because you did an article that I had read. And like I said, I love the magazine, and I want to continue to push that here in this conversation. You know, in these articles, sometimes, you know, there's a lot of learning. John Kemp has done a bunch of great articles. Steve Divers and other, there's some really smart guys and gals that have participated. But this recent trend and interest, Department of Secretary, I think she's from Texas, I can't remember her name, Brooks, kind of, anyhow.
Brooks Rowling.
Yeah, there we go. She had identified an interest in this, and it's probably a push from RFK Jr. And I think, you know, there's an interest in creating better food systems, right? That's the focus. You know, they're thinking about human health and food systems. And we're talking here a lot about animal health, but, you know, of course, you know, we need to think and breathe and act strong, and food is a big piece of this. And this supports the whole regenerative agricultural mindset of increasing soil health and water quality and resilience, which is a Mark Shepherd thing on every acre. And that's kind of a goal tied to some of the mantra, some of the things that Acres represents. So they're coming out, or they've come up with a bill. I think it was like $700 million. I don't know what the distribution is for EQIP, et cetera. But there's certain, you know, uses of this funding that people are hopeful for, that the government is actually thinking about funding activities related to regenerative agriculture, whatever regenerative agriculture means at this point. But what does that mean, you think, to current people? Because I had a client call me and said, sent me this great video off Facebook and said, how do I get this? How am I involved in this? And I'm like, you know, I think you have enough money where, you know, we can just put these practices in place. And I'm not really sure the money would even get to you, let alone support, you know, some of the wildlife things that we're working on. But I'm happy that you're paying attention to that. So I just want you to kind of run with the current bill and anything that you're concerned with, or, you know, just ideas that you have or thoughts that you have on the topic.
Well, I think the overarching positive is being regenerative agriculture, alternative agriculture, whatever you want to call it, is being talked about in an arena that it never has been. You know, I talked to a lot of different people after that announcement came out, and pretty much the main consensus is, you know, they never would have thought that the USDA would have muttered the words regenerative agriculture. Like they would have never thought they'd live to see that. So that's a win right there. Generally speaking, the bill, $400 million goes to EQIP, which is EQIP is kind of like a startup fund. You know, if you want to put fencing on, start cover cropping, you know, develop a grazing system, they help cost share those infrastructure costs. And then CSP is kind of like the maintaining of those programs, and that there's $300 million going to that. So on its face, $700 million in the grand spectrum of agriculture isn't much, but at least they are talking about it. You know, I think I come from a more libertarian type mindset where I'd rather not have the government involved in any of these things.
Yep.
Anytime you talk about more federal spending, I kind of cringe because it's like, well, what are we spending money that we don't have? But we've gotten to this point because the government has inserted itself into agriculture. And I think it came, you know, we're talking 2 weeks after, I think it was, what, $14, $20 billion bailout for commodities, which they need because the system is completely wrecked and broken. But you know, they gave us our little cherry over here of $700 million. But I'm not asking.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm not advocating for government spending. If you want a true regenerative adoption, it needs to be because it's an economic solution for farmers. And I don't want it to be because the government's paying you to do it, because then we're not really accomplishing anything. Because then when someone else comes into the office, they change the rules, then we've lost all the momentum that we've gained. Now, I do think that if people start trying it that have never tried it and they see some of the results, they might just stick with it. But the key differences, so like right now or before, like I did an NRCS thing to get our grading system set up. They would only let you pick one type of practice to put in the contract.
Yeah.
Well, what if I wanted to, you know, in theory, you buy a new property or start something like this. You know, I might want to do like water management system and the fencing infrastructure and maybe some other type of practices. And they would only they'd limit you to picking one thing. So then you'd be in this paperwork like hell where you'd have to go back and after, I don't know what it was, 3 or 4 years and apply for the next thing. So it'd be this slow moving kind of unnecessary thing. It's like, if someone's already doing all this, you might as well let them lay out the whole plan and try to fund the whole thing at once. And I like the NRCS. I like those systems because once you do it and it's set up, they're not still just sending you checks. You know, you have like a 4 or 5 year program where they'll send you a measly little check for doing it. But it's nothing to like say, it's not like you're not giving the drug dealer more money, so they keep coming back. And that's what I think subsidies really are, is, you know, if you have a no lose business system, it might not be winning by much, but if you know it's guaranteed not to lose,
right,
it's hard to leave it. So I don't want that. I don't want an endless thing that is, you know, people are just looking for handouts forever. But if it truly is the way it's supposed to be, then we can put multiple practices together in a single contract. You can essentially move your farm in the right direction fairly quickly. And then they're supposed to have some sort of outcome-based thing. So what that is still up in the air. I don't really know what that means. But hopefully we get to the point where we're testing some of the biological principles in the soil, and that's kind of like the outcome that we want. With it being said that I don't, and you said it earlier, like regenerative doesn't really have a definition to the government. I don't know if it should. We saw what happened to organic when the government got a hold of the definition and then giant corporations sweep in and they take over the definition. It's kind of already happened to regenerative, and it probably, this is going to speed it up some. And that's why we'll just move on to the next tag word. Like Acres has lived through the all natural movement, the organic movement, the sustainable movement, the regenerative movement. And it's always held on to the ecological agriculture movement. So I think we'll maintain that. But any sort of definitions then gives the government this thing where organic's major problem right now is people can't get out from under the pile of paperwork that it takes to do it properly. And we're talking about maybe a smaller operation that has to do all of these things, just not feasible. And whether that's a fair thing or not, I don't know. But when you compare it to like these giant operations of thousands of acres, they might have someone on staff just to do these things. And I think that's a little bit of the concern, is where when the government offers money like this, who actually gets it? Is it these giant operations who have someone on staff just to write grants? Maybe. Or is it actually the person who's trying to, you know, maybe the smaller type farmer that really needs some help to get their operation profitable and they could use it, but just haven't sat down, taken the time to wrap their mind around getting something like this.
Yeah.
So those are some of the positives and negatives.
I appreciate your briefing that and giving kind of like your perspective on things. And I'm sure that's a culmination of your thoughts and other leaders. And I'm sure like folks like Joe Salatin and some of those folks are in the background, probably, you know, were part of some of the initiation of some of these topics. When it comes to, and also, you know, kudos to Dan Kittredge, Bionutrient Food Association. He's kind of debunked some of the theories around organic and health benefits and all those things. And I think, you know, they're working through some different things. So kudos to Dan. He's been on this podcast. One of the things I think is, in my mind, important for the audience to kind of end with, and again, I'm going to say, please get a subscription to Acres. I would totally recommend it. I'll probably be at the conference next year. And you know, Thomas and I will probably go. So it'll be obviously nice to see you. But when it comes right down to your particular individual property and thinking about your evolution, you know, I appreciate like explaining things that you've done and changes that you've made, but a lot of this is a mindset shift. And I just want to just get like for the last few words here, what are some things that people that want to kind of change the way they think or practices that they can do? Would you think would be a good starting point for everybody to say, you know, get off the synthetic fertilizer, start thinking about healthy food systems, or, you know, if you're interested in small ruminants, what have you on the landscape? I mean, people are starting thinking more sustainable, like personally having more sustainable lifestyles. What are things that you would just push people towards thinking about, or maybe some place where they can go and learn around this particular topic?
Well, I know where they can go learn. You can just look at Acres USA and have kind of unlimited amount of material. Anyone who claims they can get through all of it, make sure you let me know and I'll send you more. You know, to like the big commodity people with the fertilizer side of things, you know, I'd love to see cattle start getting integrated back into landscapes more. And I know it is kind of scary. Like, you got Trump talking smack to cattle farmers and then the cattle prices drop by like 15% in a 2-week span. So it is kind of scary, but cattle prices are the highest they've been in a long time. It truly is a profitable endeavor. It is a little bit more difficult to get into. So like the younger people or people trying to get started, maybe wanting to start a homestead, just to give you a little bit of a scope on the difference. Like when I started my farm, I bought my first group of cattle for $1.25 for 500 pounders. Right now, that same group of cattle would be $3.50 to $4 a pound. So that's a difference of $600 a head to $2,000 to $2,500 a head. That's a wild shift in how to be profitable. Now, I will argue, if you can get cattle in the certain genetics that perform well on just grass, without all the vaccines, without all the inputs, that is kind of an impossible thing not to be profitable then. So these inputs, anyone who's using them, you're just on the conveyor belt of Big Ag. Like there's people making billions and billions of dollars, and it tends to not be the farmer. And that's because we get tied into these systems that, like I mentioned earlier, you're kind of like a heroin addict, but you keep going back for more because, you know, when you start using these inputs on soil, the soil needs it. Like you can't just cut the soil off from these synthetic inputs because it's been degraded for so long. So anyone who's looking to shift away from synthetic fertilizers or herbicides, pesticides, it needs to happen in a gradual way, you know, especially if your economic stability relies on it. But if you start implementing some cover crop practices, I think you can get there. And yeah. I think there's some products out there now that help us get there. The technology is going to be our friend on this as long as the funding goes towards that. You know, there's a lot of powerful entities or powerful things in this world that would prevent our industry from growing. But, you know, we're in the limelight now, and I think it's up to the people who are already doing it to showcase the successes they're having so then the early adopters can get in. So like, there's always the innovators who try these things. They don't care about the money. They think it's right. And it's up to them to show the blueprint for the adopters to jump in line and start doing it. And that's really what agriculture is. They need profitable systems. And then for the people who just want a more sustainable life, or, you know, want to get into the homesteading side of things, you know, chickens, pigs, those are easy entries. You know, buy a cow or two. Don't go crazy with it, because they are expensive right now. And if you just don't, if you don't know what you're doing, like I didn't know what I was doing the first couple of years, instead of me losing, you know, $5,000 or $10,000, that looks a lot different now. It looks like, you know, 30, 40. So, but just be smart, and a lot of it's just doing it and trying it and believing in yourself. I think the main thing that prevents people from taking action is in their own brain. And, there's plenty of case studies now of people having success, like Gabe and Will Harris and Joel South and all these guys. So follow that information and then fit it into your own context.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Taylor, well, thanks for taking time. I think we've pushed the business quite a bit. So hopefully folks connect and, you know, start looking at the magazine, and who knows, maybe some more new conference folks will be there. And if you do go to the conference, and I'll talk about that prior to the conference happening next year, you know, get a hold of me, and it'd be great to meet up with some people that have, you know, kind of like-minded mindsets. And there's a lot of products out there, even in our world. Vitalize Seed has some products that they've sent me, and BioAgs, another company that we mentioned here, that have some good products. So there'll be some more resources that we'll mention throughout the year that are a little bit more kind of that natural, you know, choice that may be beneficial if you're trying to amp things up a little bit. And, you know, time is of the essence, and people don't like to wait. And so I understand that it takes time to build these systems. You mentioned, you know, 20 years potentially for a plant to express itself eventually after, you know, probably a good, you know, I guess, process that Gabe Brown had in play. But it takes time for these things. And I think patience is a virtue, and it's hard to get people to kind of buy into that. But I appreciate you taking time out of your day and sharing with us. And, you know, it's just, it's great to have all these resources and great books. And that's why I think Acres is kind of a special place that, you know, I've learned about and kind of leveraged over the past several years. So I appreciate you taking the reins and willing to share.
Thanks, John. And I'll say on that time thing, patience is the key here. You know, especially if you're a hunter or you own recreational type land, you know, what is that land for? Is it, are you pulling economic returns on it right now? Most likely not. To me, our property is meant for the next generation. And if you can think out 30, 50 year type ideas, all of these practices make a lot more sense. It's when we get cornered in economically that these decisions get a little bit more difficult. So if you have the ability and you don't have the economic pressures necessarily, I'm not saying just go waste a bunch of money, but these things can, I think we're going to get paid well in the future for some of these things. Like we're talking about nutrient density, getting an actual scorecard down the line. Like the people who have their soil set up to perform without some of these chemicals are going to get rewarded in the next 15 to 20 years.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, great ending point there, and I appreciate that. And we'll talk again soon. See ya.
All right, John. Thanks a lot.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
USAA knows dynamic duos can save the day, like superheroes and sidekicks or auto and home insurance. With USAA, you can bundle your auto and home and save up to 10%. Tap the banner to learn more and get a quote at usaa.com/bundle. Restrictions apply.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Right now, get up to 20% off select online storage solutions. Put heavy-duty HDX totes to good use, protecting what's important to you. The solid, impact-resistant design prevents cracking, and the clear base and sides make items easy to find, even when the totes are stacked. Find select online shelving and tote storage up to 20% off at the Home Depot to organize every room in your home, from your garage to your attic. Visit homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.